Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Here in the studio today, we've got a very special guest, Fiona Davies from Infinitive, who's MD of International. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Good to have you here. And we have ExchangeWire's head of content, Lindsay Rowntree. Hi, Lindsay.
Hello.
How's it going?
Delighted to be surrounded by Australians today.
It's kind of turning into the Mad Tech, the Australian Mad Tech Mafia. Yeah. Well, basically, that's just you and Liam Brennan from a couple of weeks ago.
Lovely.
Excellent. Nothing wrong with it.
We're taking over the world.
Yeah. Right. Rightly so. Okay, so as regular listeners will be familiar with the format of this podcast, we're going to launch into a couple of news stories for the week and have a bit of a chit chat about those. First up, I wanted to talk a bit about a fairly extensive article that appeared in WSJ this week on Amazon's advertising business, the growth of that business, the associated growth of its own labels, sort of via that growing advertising business, and what it's doing to e-commerce search and performance marketing, because the article also came with some fairly extensive stats on Amazon's predicted growth over the next couple of years in ad sales, far outstripping Tencent and Alibaba, which is a pretty impressive looking figure. And it also talked a little bit about the advantage or the edge that it has over Google and Facebook in the context of data, that it's actually got purchase data, actual live real purchase data, and what does that do to Google and Facebook's position. So a couple of questions there. What do you think about its advertising business and the growth of its advertising business? And what do you think the impact of that is going to be on the world of Google and Facebook in the advertising context? And then also, thirdly, what is it doing to e-commerce search and performance marketing in totality, since it's not just about their advertising business?
Yeah, sure. I should take the last question first.
All right.
So, interesting, everyone's talking about their growth outstripping Alibaba and Tencent and the like in the APAC region. In reality, they've already got a massive stranglehold on that market. So Amazon's like scratching around at the surface down there, and they're both going after new markets in the same areas, but doing it in a slightly different way. Mm. So Amazon's literally trying to expand its own footprint and doing lots of direct acquisitions, whereas Alibaba's just investing in lots of strategic players, particularly in India. So there's definitely been there's a huge focus on that area, because that's Amazon now sees that that's where its growth is going to be, is in international, because they're getting to a point where they haven't maxed out the whole US market, but it's getting pretty close to saturation point there. Mm. So the money's going to come from somewhere, and it's going to be outside of Europe and the US. So I think it's not as cut and dried and open slather for them as what I think a lot of people think it is, because Alibaba's and it's not just Alibaba, but Flipkart and players like that in the region know the region and also know the logistical challenges of shipping stuff down there way more than what Amazon does at the moment. So I think that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch play out.
Because there was all the sort of, fuss over Amazon launching in Singapore and also elsewhere in the Asian region and completely getting the delivery and the charging system totally wrong.
Yeah. You speak to anybody out in Singapore, they all just go, oh, it was a shit show.
Yeah.
It was an embarrassment.
Yeah.
And they were really excited about Amazon coming in and bringing them something a bit different from what they're getting from the likes of Alibaba. And they were just like, oh no, they did it so wrong.
Yeah.
How can they not understand our market that badly? Mm. And that's a worry for them, because that's their kind of their starting opening gambit into launching in that region. And they completely screwed it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the market dynamics here is very different. It's not just about money. You actually have to have relationships there. And China in particular, you can't just go wading in there with your cash and hoping you're going to make a dent. You've actually got to you've got to have relationships very high up in government to be able to influence decision making there. So I think it's a much more challenging space than potentially the US market is for them.
Yeah.
And also that the focus on mobile in that region as well. Alibaba's done an amazing job of getting that right, because especially in places like India and China, where the vast majority of the purchases are so much higher as a percentage on mobile than they are in other countries. So Amazon's product's good, but I don't think it's as good as what those guys have been having in market for a long time too.
And what about, the WSJ article was focusing a little bit more on the opportunity that they've got to push their own brands.
Yes.
And the kind of search side of things.
Yeah,
what about that?
I mean, I think that's fascinating, because I think a lot of retailers that advertise on Amazon now, it's very much, you know, better the devil you know. They know they have to advertise on Amazon, but they also know that Amazon are taking all of their own retail data, largely not giving it back to them. So they really have no idea what's going on. There's not much visibility or transparency in terms of data they're getting as retailers advertising their products or selling their products on the Amazon platform. Amazon are taking it and then creating it themselves under their own Amazon own label brand. And retailers are powerless, literally powerless. They know it's happening, and they all it means they have to do. And there's a great example in the article of, I can't say the name, Bokeball or something. To make sure they still get traction, Amazon just took that product and copied it, and now they now sell their own brandless version of it. Now that company has to not just appear on Amazon under those search listings, they have to advertise against it. So actually, whether Amazon intended that or not, they're actually also forcing these brands to advertise and sponsor products so that they're appearing top. That's just giving them more revenue. So there's kind of like, it's going full circle, really. So it is an interesting dilemma that retailers are in.
Yeah, absolutely. For CPG companies in particular, it's where they don't have a direct-to-consumer relationship. It is the better the devil you know, and they don't really have too many options at the moment until the retailers catch up. Like, I do feel like there are some retailers that see the scary danger of it and are like your Targets and those guys that have actually got, you know, relatively good solutions. But again, they don't have the kind of global branding and reach and as what Amazon does at the moment. So I think it's a fine balance, I think, for the big, you know, someone like a P&G or a Reckitt Benckiser, they're not necessarily the type of products necessarily. It depends on what the product is. If it's like the fast-moving consumer goods, like finished dish tablets or something like that, it's incredibly hard to get someone to come and buy that from you directly. So it's always going to go through a retailer, and Amazon's done an amazing job of marketing their own products, and their growth shows that the approach works. And if you compare that to, you know, CPGs have been trying to get data out of retailers as well for a long time, and they won't share it. So, you know, they've kind of handed the market to Amazon in a way by not providing a better, like, I think it comes back to the whole walled garden concept of, if either one of them agreed to share real data, so you could DMP pixel something and pull data back in and profile your own audience and see not just from advertising and conversions, but how your brand advertising is actually impacting stuff off Amazon properties, you know, people will be eating that up. So I think there's still that people are quite nervous about, do I go all in on Amazon? Because if I do, I'm not going to be able to get that data back out to inform my own brand strategies.
And it's hard to pull out of it once you have then taken that leap and gone, okay.
It's like heroin.
Exactly. It's like heroin. I was going to say like joining a cult, but heroin's probably better. It's very difficult to relinquish control. Like, you've given all your control to Amazon, basically. Yeah. And then how do you pull away? Because you know that once you do pull away, you're going to lose a lot of sales because Amazon is helping drive
that. Well, that's exactly it. You would either have to be, as you said, perhaps a DTC brand that's got its own really clever solution and that's sort of built outside of that platform altogether.
Yeah.
Or you just have to, be really good at getting yourself off heroin.
Well, I mean, because the reality is it works. That's like their growth shows, and people are advertising with them because it works, bottom line. And it's hard to argue against, especially when you got, you know, marketers have so much pressure on advertising budgets. If you can point at a product where you can do full closed loop measurement and attribution on your media buys, well, of course you're going to keep doing it.
And what about, so, you know, on that point and sort of, focusing on the data element as well, that they've got that actual purchase data, what does that make them look like in terms of on the performance marketing side of things in comparison to Google and Facebook?
I think it puts them in a strong position for brands that are looking to get consumers when they're already at the point of purchase. So Google and Facebook could very well be used for prospecting, and, you know, it's kind of a visibility play for when they're scrolling through a newsfeed or looking at other properties. But actually, if I'm on Amazon, I'm probably likely to buy. So if I, as an advertiser, can get my brand in front of those people that are already looking to buy, that puts them in a powerful place and puts them at the, like, further along the funnel than Google and Facebook probably can. I mean, Google can do it, but it's all very keyword dependent. And the way that you'd have a search strategy around, if I'm doing a prospecting play or I'm doing a kind of closed purchase loop play, is very, very different and gets infinitely more expensive the further along you go. Amazon, in comparison, the clicks are still fairly cheap. They have increased massively since demand has gone up, but they are still fairly cheap compared to some search keywords on Google. And you know that person isn't probably researching. They probably are looking to buy very soon.
I think I've said this on... I don't know how many podcasts since we've started this. It's been the sort of journey of Rachel Smith buying a house. I've used this example so many times, but because I've just recently bought a house, I've been shopping a lot. I'm using Amazon as a proxy search engine. Yeah. I think of something I need and I just go directly to Amazon and see what search results it throws up. And that's just going to happen, you know, if their search capabilities get more and more clever and more refined, that's going to keep happening.
Mm. Well, and what's interesting about that too is, I think Google should be scared on that front because a lot of people don't even price check anymore. So some people will still use price comparison sites for bigger purchases and will shop around for a fridge or something like that. But for, nuts and bolts like buying a cable or buying a set of headphones or getting some grocery stuff like that.
Over the door hooks, I bought a lot of those.
Yeah. Well, also because it's just the convenience of it, right? The time turnaround and the delivery
side. And they've completely got you cornered as well as a customer, right? I'm an Amazon Prime member, so I just think, well, I'm going to buy that on Amazon because I'm going to get it quickly.
Yeah.
And it's, a far more, it's just a convenient one-click transaction.
Yeah. And I'm an Amazon user as well, and I've noticed recently where they are promoting their own products over brands and you've got to pay big money to keep pushing yourself further and further up the chain. And as they get all the analytics around the products that are selling well and they're building out their own products, then they are directly competing with the people that are advertising with them. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out over time. I do think what's interesting, though, is to your earlier point, Lindsay, about it's about conversion metrics. And the danger in that is as not a retailer, but an actual brand, like someone who doesn't have a direct consumer relationship, you still have to do a lot of brand advertising to even give someone awareness so that when they're on Amazon, they know who you are. Mm. So that focus around if you're putting all your money just at the purchase funnel level, well, you're relying
it's
on
discovery. Help you build your brand.
Well, you're just relying on search and discovery to find your brand. That is, you're not going to win
it's
that way either.
No.
So I think it's the danger is that people get so obsessed with conversion metrics that they're not doing a proper full funnel approach to how they need to be advertising.
Yeah.
So, and I think it just comes back to it's just one piece of the marketing mix, not the only piece.
Yeah.
But I guess to your other questions, or are they a danger to? I think they're probably more of a danger to Google from a search perspective and comparative perspective. Facebook is still doing a lot of branding. So I think they'll still have a place in the market, but there's definitely more pressure on them to show attribution and show what they can show attribution today, but it's all last click, which is kind of what Amazon's doing as well, although they can probably give you more data around general customer journey and search terms and stuff like that and how many times people came back to the site before they actually bought. But, Facebook has got some pretty good metrics around that type of stuff as well.
Yeah, Facebook does it really well, particularly from I hate to say it, but for a cross-device attribution perspective, they're really, really hot on that. And also they are able, if you scroll down a Facebook newsfeed, I no longer have a Facebook account, but when I did, they would all be kind of generally all these sort of DTC brands targeting me. And it's great for both from the enterprise level across all Facebook's properties, but also from the kind of startup level for those that want to just go in, open up the Facebook account and then create an ad there and then in their account. Facebook do that really well. Amazon also do it really well, but they don't do the enterprise thing so well yet. So the big brands looking to really, really kind of invest in Amazon and use them as almost their third partner outside Google and Facebook, there's still a bit of a long way to go in terms of Amazon giving them the support they need. But you are starting to see kind of Amazon teams within search and social teams.
Yeah.
And you're also starting to see in-housing, people that have in-house search actually creating Amazon search teams as well. So that is just going to keep growing. Amazon still have a long way to go, but they'll definitely get there.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting though for CPG companies, people that are actually selling a specific product, for companies that aren't in that e-commerce space that have their own transactional, like financial services, for instance, it's less of an attractive option because they're not going to sell a credit card through Amazon. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So it's a very different set of advertisers that are focused in that area, I think. So it's not going to be a catch-all, it's the perfect solution for everybody.
No.
But definitely in the retail space and e-commerce space, I think they're going to dominate.
Mm. On the topic of dominance, I'm going to move us on to the next news story. This is a news story about Apple appearing in courts again in the US. Actually, it's the Supreme Court ruling against Apple on their efforts to block some of their customers suing them for monopoly in charging 30% commission on App Store in the App Store. And What I thought was interesting about this article, it appeared in a couple of news outlets, including The Telegraph, is that it says something, I think, in my opinion, about regulation coming down the line towards big tech companies, right? Supreme Court very clearly stated there's no reason why people shouldn't be able to challenge the monopoly of Apple in this context. And since that ruling, the prediction is that Apple's revenue could decrease quite significantly from losing the ability in certain circumstances. Try saying that first thing in the morning. to charge commission at such a hefty rate, right? So I find it interesting because we talk a lot about the dominance of Google and Facebook, of course, in this industry, but then also increasingly about Apple and also Amazon and other companies. Is this going to be the start of actual laws being put in place to prevent these companies monopolizing in certain areas? What do you think?
Yes. I think it's probably a long time coming. And if you speak to gaming companies, that they've been battling against this for a while, because particularly where you've got, it's one thing Apple taking 30% of somebody purchasing an app. But if you are a company that makes your revenue from in-app purchases, Apple are taking 30% of all of that as well. So actually, it then comes down to it, despite how many millions or billions you're making in in-app purchase revenue, a huge chunk of it is going to Apple for basically doing nothing, because the app publisher has no choice but to stick their apps on the Apple App Store. There's no other way of accessing those apps on Apple hardware. I mean, Android charge as well. Google do charge for people in-app purchases and publishing apps on the Google Play Store. It's lower. I'm not sure.
And I think
it is much lower. And people are moaning about that as well. And you did have the likes of Fortnite threatening to become a self-publisher so they would be able to avoid the Android Play Store and App Store completely. But then the concerns around that is there's a high risk of fraud. So what the likes of Apple and Android would come back and say is, we are giving you a secure environment to host your apps. So actually for that and all the measures we take and everything that we invest in to ensure that everything is safe for you, you're getting legitimate users. I mean, probably less on the Android side at the moment because they're in a lot of trouble for that. But certainly from the Apple side, they're saying this is worthwhile investment for you. Mm. Otherwise, who knows who could be using your app and how they could be defrauding you.
But which is fair, but not 30%.
I was going to say,
I agree. Exactly. Also, it does still feel robbery. Like it's ripe for regulation, because all of those principles are, morally correct. But they're still completely dominating. They're doing what they're creating a marketplace and doing what they want within that marketplace, and they're not enabling anyone to compete with them in that regard. No. So
yeah, but to be honest, like the reality is, they do have it. Them and Google have a stranglehold on the market. So you can
stranglehold a lot today because we're just talking about all these companies that you have no choice but to use them.
Yeah,
and that's why you get Kieran obviously on this topic. That's why you do feel like we are maybe coming to a period in the digital world's history where we will start to see the breaking up of elements of some of these companies. We've talked about this in the context of other stories in previous podcasts. What, can you imagine that Google and Facebook will be able to continue to acquire new bits and pieces of companies to add to their advertising offerings? And you have to wonder the same for Apple. Somebody's going to get in the way at some stage from a regulatory perspective to put the consumer at the heart of this and say, well, this isn't fair, because ultimately the person that's suffering the most is the consumer. They're just having no choice but to operate in that environment. And I just think this is the start of more to come.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an appetite. Like you can see it with GDPR in Europe, that they are starting to prosecute. They are starting to go after people just in that space. I think there's definitely an appetite for it, more so in Europe than potentially in the States. But even in the States, it comes up pretty regularly around the monopolies that those companies have. Mm. But I think actually there's that, and there's taxation as well. Like that's still, if you think about, everyone knows that it should be more pressed by the governments in every country to try and get Amazon and Google and Facebook and those guys to pay more tax, but it never actually happens. Mm. So I think it's a long-term kind of change, and I don't necessarily see it changing in the immediate future, but there's definitely an appetite for it on the regulatory side to try and push it. Mm. I don't know, maybe we'll just continue to get shafted by them.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I think it is interesting that regulators are finally sitting up and taking notice and starting to do things about it. But that doesn't mean by any means that the big four, I mean, if you in France,
no, it doesn't
they
call mean
them,
they'll be
call them GAFA, but so Google, Apple, Facebook and Amazon, doesn't mean that they need to be worried anytime soon. And, you know, Facebook are going through absolute turmoil at the moment, but it's not stopping anyone advertising on them. Yeah. It's not stopping, you know, people still using them. It'll be a blip.
These are still companies that make an enormous amount of revenue and are very, very sitting very, you know, very comfortably from a financial perspective. And it sort of feels like it's the thing of the day, right? Yeah. Discussing dominance of big tech giants.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be completely, you know, handcuffed tomorrow, does it?
You have to remember as well, though, like, it's different for someone like Apple. It's so much harder to break into a hardware market and bring out a new operating system, right? Mm. That's a hell of a lot of money to get something set, and it's expensive to set up in this day and age to try and compete with companies like that, especially with security issues. Whereas like a Facebook or somebody like that, I mean, they've got so much money, they can just keep buying up whoever they want to. But reality is you could come up with a new product in that space and then just take over the market. I don't think it's the same for hardware vendors.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
and that's what's interesting about that story, right? That it is going to impact their revenue. That's where they look to make extra bits and pieces of money.
Yeah.
And they've been able to run with that and do what they want.
Yeah.
So, you know, even just a moderate reduction in their 30% commission will probably result in a huge reduction in revenue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely would. Yeah.
But we talk about Amazon, you know, becoming the second search engine. Apple has a big play in the search space as well, because they're starting to really, really push the paid search ads within the App Store too. And App Store optimization is a big thing and becoming a bigger thing for those that want traction amongst the billions of apps that exist in the App Store. So that could be another massive revenue generator for them. So if they can make that work, they could then say, okay, fine, we will reduce that fee slightly, or they might even then start charging people, because, you know, if I'm a big player that people can download my app for free, but then they have to progress or whatever, have to do so via in-app purchases, Amazon are taking 30% of that, but there's millions upon millions of completely free-to-play, free-to-use apps on there. So those that are charging are actually paying for those free-to-play, free-to-use apps to be able to do so and use their product for free. So it's a bit of a disconnect, really, and a bit of an imbalance that Apple might need to sort out and start being a bit nicer to the ones that it's getting all its money from.
Yeah. Okay, moving us on to the third story of the day. I want us to talk briefly about the news that WPP are merging Wunderman and JWT. Of course, we've been watching with interest what WPP have been up to since Sir Martin Sorrell's exit and Mark Read's appointment as the CEO. And I'm interested to know from both of you your opinion on that, because there's a lot of chat within the advertising industry anyway about the way in which Mark Read's managing WPP at the moment and the kind of manoeuvres he's making. Ultimately, he's no doubt putting a stamp on the company, you know, to sort of say this is characteristic of his leadership. But there's also lots of chat to suggest that he's got more of an interest in the creative side of the business or the creative agencies within the holding companies than he does the traditional media agencies. And of course, we spend a lot of time also talking about traditional media agency models. So I'm interested to hear your opinion on this. Is this you know, further to the sort of suggestion that Mark Read's a bit more interested in the creative side of the business, or is this just a natural, inevitable merging of some parts of the business for financial and kind of strategic reasons?
Yeah, I definitely think it's the latter. Mm. I mean, that's not to say he's not interested in creative and that ultimately that's the differentiator between them and, say, the new players in the market like an Accenture that are pushing hard on technology and implementation and data integration, who are also buying up creative agencies. But I think that's the one area where agencies, the holding companies, have been very strong for a long period of time, and a lot of the media stuff's been commoditized. And I mean, bottom line, he needs to consolidate. They've bought so many companies over the years and had so many disparate. It is basically what he's saying. Like, it makes sense to merge some of those companies because, you know, big companies that are working with a holding company are expecting them to be able to provide a full suite of services from creative all the way through to data analytics, programmatic buying, whatever it is. They don't want to deal with five different agencies to get those services. They just want to deal with one. And just simplifying that makes sense from a client standpoint. I absolutely believe that. But also that they need to cut heads.
Yeah.
Bottom line, their growth has not been there and they're going to have to consolidate at some point, and not, you know, he's going to make his mark. He's inherited Martin Sorrell's business, so
yeah,
he's got to make some changes, and I don't think that's necessarily driven by, you know, thinking that creative is the only thing that's important in that space. It's just simple business metrics.
What do you reckon, Lindsay?
I mean, I think it's, if you look at kind of how the whole codes have been making their money, the growth has certainly been from the media side of the business over the past few years. It certainly hasn't made up the bulk of their revenue, but they've been growing in that space for a long time. Creative has actually still been the, almost the cash cow for them, and probably helped them be able to put more into the media side of the business. But as the you know, as you said, Rachel, we talk about the media agency model a lot. As that's starting to change and become more complicated, do you think that Mark Reed is seeing a greater opportunity in getting creative right? And then will other holdcos start to follow that thread?
I think it's more repositioning themselves as the differentiator. So they'll still be full service agencies and still be, I mean, there's a huge amount of money in them providing full media buying services for people. It's more about positioning themselves differently than the new players like an Accenture or a Deloitte and saying, we are the creative smarts in the room. So yeah, I kind of, it is important and it is a cash cow, but it's also difficult to deliver on. And it's, you know, it's a competitive marketplace and it's hard to retain the best talent, in that space. So, you know, I think it's a combination of he's just trying to reposition them in a market that's super competitive now.
Yeah, cash cow and problem child. But I mean, also, if you're looking at kind of the digitization and automation of media, the creative is still that one disconnect between the entire thread. I mean, from my days working digital, the creative element of it was always the by far the most frustrating, because the creative agency used to dance their own beat, basically, and do what they wanted. And you'd be trying to do a display campaign and you'd be given the 30 second TV spot and said, there you go, there's your ad. No, that's not going to help. That's not what I need. And trying to get them to understand that. And that then forced the media agencies to start investing in their own kind of creative pools and their own sort of creative teams to actually deliver on that front. That then made it more complicated with the JWTs and the Wondermans of the world. And it became, the disconnect became even stronger. Mm-hmm. Actually, maybe what Mark Reed's doing will probably help align them better and make them more what the future creative needs to look like.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really good point, Lindsay, around if you've got completely separate teams, like one team's doing digital, one team's doing outdoor, one team's doing TV, there's not really a cohesive strategy towards doing that. And if you've got both sides of the fence in the same room together, they can put together a much more cohesive strategy for a client than if you've got three different agencies producing the work.
Mm. And you would think, this is kind of a helpful segue actually into the next section, which is a bit more of a chit chat about what you're up to, Fiona. You would think that that would be much more sort of compelling pitch to a client, right?
Absolutely.
From your experience, yeah, of being on the consultancy side of the fence and being involved in client pitches and things like that.
Yeah.
What do you see that clients really want to get from their agencies? Like you said, bit of a one-stop shop. They don't want to have to necessarily deal with half a dozen people. But surely the creative stuff is still really compelling for most clients.
I think like often what we see with clients that are working with multiple different agencies is they do run up against this disparate strategies and the left hand not necessarily knowing what the right hand's doing. And there is definitely a push to do more holistic full funnel campaigns where they're measuring all elements and all channels at the same time and trying to do a more holistic approach to how they're planning, for sure. And if, like, they're, you know, creative is the differentiator. You know, table stakes is good media buying, programmatic buying in the right channels, good data analysis, good audience targeting is table stakes. And if you're not doing that well, people are just going to switch agencies. Mm. I think the creative piece is what sets people apart. If you can come up with an amazing concept that, you know, drives real interest and brand awareness in the market, that's what people are going to remember you for. They just expect that you will get media buying right. Which is,
that's like the basic lowest common denominator.
Unfair. Yeah, exactly. Actually, super unfair to media buying agencies because it is not an easy job.
It's actually,
and it takes
way more
a lot of work, and it's complex, and it's, you know, sometimes an incredibly thankless task, and people expect you to do it for next to nothing. So, it is a fine balance between, but you have to get the operational side of it right for people to want to continue working with you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So tell us a little bit more about what you're up to at Infinitive.
So right now we've seen huge growth in audio advertising, which is super interesting for us. We've got a couple of clients both on the buying side and on the selling side that are focused on trying to come up with new products in the market for new ways of presenting content, both from a native standpoint, like podcasting, that kind of stuff, but also literally streaming ads in audio streaming content. And I think what's interesting is about what we were talking about earlier with Amazon. At the moment, they say they're not going to do advertising on Alexa I cannot imagine that's going to continue over the long term, because there's so much, like, the more and more people are moving to voice activated mediums, and, you know, somebody's like your Spotify's and Pandora's are doing some pretty amazing advertising campaigns in their space. And the fact that it's so, you can do such great location based when people are in their car, when people are on the move, people are listening to podcasts, are listening to music on the tube, you can advertise to people in ways that you can't necessarily advertise them to them in display or in video in all mediums. So whereas audio crosses all kind of locations, and you get a real mix of people that are listening as well, whether it's digital radio streaming or whether it's music streaming, whatever it is. And it's interesting that a lot of the measurement technology that's there today doesn't really cover audio particularly well. Audience targeting and stuff, there's not out-of-the-box products that integrate particularly well with audio products, so it's a huge space for growth, I think, in the industry for sure.
Yeah, can you see some potential solutions being developed around that then?
Absolutely. And it's seen some really interesting ad campaigns over the years of what people are doing in store, like with Shazam and in store with Walmart, and you're hearing a song and you Shazam it and they clock you in the store and then they start pushing text messages to you. There's all kinds of interesting stuff that you can do. But one of our other clients are trying to get people in their cars when they're getting petrol. So, yeah, all kinds of they just want to know how close are they and what promotions do we have in that shop at the time that we can push to them when they get there, and integration with the digital screens on the Bowsers, petrol Bowsers, all kinds of stuff. So it's, yeah, quite fascinating seeing it grow. And the growth has been so quick. It went from zero to, like, a huge chunk of revenue within literally 2 years. Like 2 years ago, we were barely talking about it, and now everyone wants to talk about it. So
that's very interesting, because actually I was having a conversation with someone the other day who was saying that they think audio as well, as a, from conversations they're having, audio represents a huge growth area, but they feel outside of that, no one's really talking about it anymore. And it's kind of been a bit quiet this year. Like, if you think back to 2 years ago, everyone was talking about audio, and OpenRTB had upgraded their standards, so kind of, you know, the audio object became a big thing, and everyone was talking about how you can do server-side ad insertion and kind of how you could actually make audio the best it could be and what the opportunities were, and they just kind of went a bit quiet. So it's really interesting to see that people are picking up on it again.
I think because there's a lot of tech challenges involved,
exactly,
for selling it in the way that you sell other types of media. Yeah. So it's still like the technology's got to catch up with the promise of what people want to do with it. And, you know, effectively some of the companies that produce that type of content would need to build their own solutions in lieu of there not being something available. Mm. So, you know, simple ad serving is fine, but if you're trying to do streaming, live streaming, radio or whatever, and doing ad insertion for that, it's and to measure it the same way you measure digital is quite different, so...
And it seems like it's quite fragmented as well. Like, if you want to go into the audio space, you need to be quite creative in how you would strategize what you want to do with it, because there aren't a ton of opportunities. Like, you know, talking about Amazon not getting in the ad space yet, which is frankly fairly crazy. But there's a couple of agencies that are trying to game the system basically with Alexa and try to get their brands to be higher organically, so run advertising campaigns online so that when people are using their Alexa device to search for something, they will then automatically appear at the top listing to be added to the basket. And that's kind of how you can increase your brand presence on Alexa. But outside of that, it feels like there's so much more that could be done. So it's the kind of creative thinking around audio I'm fascinated by.
And surely companies like Amazon and others have got to stop making bold claims about not using advertising in certain contexts, because invariably when someone says that, it turns out to be a massive lie.
Yeah. You
know? We're never going to have advertising in this product. Actually, we might change our minds about that.
Exactly.
But also too, surely it sort of almost follows a trend. So perhaps a couple of years ago we were talking about it because it was an obvious sort of new channel, particularly for programmatic. Like you say, Fiona, the tech wasn't really there. It perhaps still isn't quite there yet. Everybody's kind of catching up. But it becomes a kind of a trend in the way that people sort of consume things before you know it, right? Because I think rowing back 2 years ago, I'm not sure that I was consuming so much stuff in an audio capacity as I am now. It's like it almost descends on us before we know it. And then before you know it, the proposition is really compelling, and you can just see companies thinking, good God, we've got to get hold of this, because this is obviously a potentially really fruitful channel for us.
Well, and what's interesting is because especially in the broadcast space and the audio space, there's so many non-advertising products. Like if you've got the paid subscriber model, then you're not getting any ads. And the growth for those companies is coming from Netflix included. Once you reach market saturation, then what's your growth strategy? Either you have to jack your price up for the people that are already subscribed, or you have to do a free model where there's advertising. So I think there'll be a drive from both the content producers and from brand marketers as that market shrinks, because people are just paying for subscriber-based services and I don't want to see advertising, trying to find different ways where they can reach people.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see what that growth looks like and how open people are to, once you flip to a subscriber model, I don't know about you, but you never really want to go back to the advertising
model.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
But I guess over time, there is a point at which people just want to get access to radio or music
out,
and stuff.
Right? Yeah. Like there's only so many, we've talked about this in the context of TV as well, haven't we?
Yeah.
There's only so many subscriptions you're probably going to take up.
Yeah.
And so at some point you make some choices.
Yeah.
And you might be, and that trade-off, we all understand in a modern world, is, okay, I've got to deal with some advertising.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see as well what's the new metric going to be for audio auditability.
Oh Lord, God. No.
We've definitely got to invent a three-letter acronym for that, surely.
Did someone hear my ad?
Yeah.
So simple stuff like that, where like having the conversation around, well, what's the impact of it, and is it, do you see it more as brand advertising? Because the delay and attribution is probably more of a challenge there, depending, because if it's a mobile device or you're in the car, it might be 2 days later before you actually go and look at the product.
Yeah.
It's more, brand awareness-y type stuff. But, I could be wrong about that. There's plenty of conversion-based metrics for some of those audio products today that are pretty compelling as well. So,
You could see this getting really complex, though. I'm thinking about other sort of smart-enabled devices that you've got around your house that allegedly learn your, I don't know, movements. For example, my Nest, which when I first moved into my new house controlled everything beyond where I wanted it to. Yeah. So actually it was like having an alien in my home. And I'm thinking, I should be able to get control of this thing, but I can't. Anyway, it's all settled down and we're friends now. But it knows.
Did you have to practice your stern voice, Rachel?
And I get a lot of practice at the stern voice, as you can imagine, here at Exchange Wire Towers. Now that we know one another's movements, I'm kind of, freaked out and also delighted by the fact that it kind of just knows when to switch the heating on without me telling it now.
Yeah.
Imagine the possibilities for all sorts of things that go on in a household environment where you could be getting all sorts of subliminal advertising messages.
Yeah, and I think it's also, it's interesting how it's crept up on people, 2 years ago, did you think you'd be using so much voice activation? People didn't even Siri.
That's what I mean.
Alexa, whatever it is. And over time, I feel like people are just going to stop typing.
Yeah.
Just talk at your laptop.
Yeah.
You can do it in WhatsApp,
right?
Yeah, but you can do it now. Yeah. Dragon, naturally speaking, has been around for years.
It has, a long time.
Yeah, but for some reason,
people just haven't been using it. That's what I mean, is it almost becomes just a kind of a fashion or a trend after a while.
Well, I think it's more like logistics, right? So when you're in an office, if everyone's sitting around talking at their laptops, that's reasonably disruptive versus, but as people are working more flexibly, if you're working from home, then I'd rather get up and walk around the room and be talking at a device than sitting there typing all day.
Having a phone tucked under your
ear. Tucked under your ear, exactly. Just get yourself a little headset, Madonna-style headset, and walk around the house talking.
I still do the whole phone tucked under the ear. And I had someone recently say to me, "What is this, like 1955? You can actually remove the phone from your ear and put it on speaker and then carry on about your business."
Yeah. Something weird about that, isn't there, though? It must be an age thing. I do the same. I find it really weird when someone, "You've got me on speakerphone."
Yeah. Anything else about maybe just a little quick recap on Infinitiv's position in Europe at the moment? So you're working mostly with brands directly, or you're also doing some work with?
So my specific practice works with brands directly.
Yeah.
And we work a lot with agencies because obviously
part of that
process is they obviously have existing relationships and want to make sure that they're getting the most out of them, but on both sides of the house. But we also have a very big media and pubs practice as well. So we look at both the buy and the sell side of the house, which is an interesting viewpoint because you get to see all of the challenges on both sides of the fence. And it's interesting to see the movement in that space where, you know, when I was working for a publisher 5 years ago, the agency had a massive stranglehold on all of the buying decisions. Now what you're seeing is clients and or brands and publishers talking much more directly with each other because they want to share data, because they recognize that some of the large broadcasters, for instance, have got large in-house creative teams to come up with new concepts as well. So they're not just working with the agency, they're working directly with some of the big and some of the big digital advertisers as well. So it's the marketplace has changed quite significantly since I was working on that side of the house too. So
that's really interesting. Isn't that something that we've been sort of asking a few people about at our most recent ATS events as well, is that relationship between the publisher and the brand getting closer?
Yeah, you're definitely seeing more as you go through, like people start just with data sharing agreements, and then actually often the conversation starts doing a P&P deal with programmatic, and then they're like, wow, look at this data, what else can you do? And when they actually start talking directly to each other, they recognize that the publisher can tell them so much about the content and what the behaviors of the users beyond just what the advertising campaign is doing, and like can help around contextualization of stuff as well. So that you see them definitely in my day, we would do some pitches where the agency would bring us into the room and we'd be talking directly to the clients. Now I think that conversation is happening even without the agency in the room. They're still buying through the agency. I don't think that's going to change. It's just more of a collaborative kind of partnership type approach to how they're doing business now.
And is this the right way to do it? Or is there a danger that this it will then start sort of disintermediating? Did I say that correctly? Disintermediation.
You did, yes.
That correctly. That sounded really wrong. No. So like the tech layer and also the agencies. If the agencies aren't in the room, that's just going to make them feel more that they're not part of the
No, I think it's more... So the agency is always going to be driving the overall strategy of how they want to approach it, because they, you know, they're doing creative strategy. They're doing the whole kind of soup to nuts. What having the publisher in the room is helping with is if they want to do a very specific campaign where the publisher is the expert in that data and the expert in the content that's being produced, they need to be part of that creative conversation too to get it right. And I think they recognize that the more conversations they're having direct with the brand, the more they're understanding what the brand's after and what type of metrics they want to measure. And then they can work with the agency to go, okay, if that's what they want to do, then we need to set it up in this way so that you can measure it in the way that they're looking for. So it's just more of a three-way conversation now, whereas previously it was 100% went through the agency and there was no conversation between the client and the publisher. I think that's probably the main thing that's changed.
And what does it do to the tech piece? Anything in particular?
No, I think it's what is interesting is the closer that a brand gets to a publisher, the more transparent they tend to be around costs. Like they're never going to be no one's going to say, yeah, I'm making X amount of margin out of you necessarily, but they are getting a much better understanding about, hang on, my actual working media dollars is only X, so the publisher's only getting this much from me. I think maybe you'll get, they would be able to influence some of those sort of the tech tax that's happening in between them and sort of push those tech platforms more towards a higher level of transparency. It's got there, I think, on the DSP side. There's definitely been a heavy push on the brand side for that. But more recently, there's a lot more pressure on the SSPs now as well. So
That's not news really, is it?
Yeah. No.
Okay, we've run out of time. So thanks very much, Fiona.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being the second guest Aussie and making Lindsay feel like the ethnic minority in the room.
Ethnic minority.
Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks, everyone, for listening. That was Mad Tech Podcast.